I thought you were saying common side when you were saying carbon side.
Uh-huh.
All right, so explain that again.
I'll make it clear. He said, well, you've even put the carbon side in backwards. And I said, yes, but look what it does. He saw the idea of that and said, well, it stopped him in his tracks. He said, it gives me an idea. To which I was sort of inclined to say, well, that was the idea, but I didn't try to rub it in. That must have been about 13 at that point.
Mm-hmm. But I'm so, sorry, I'm still unclear as to how it worked.
Well, if you want to, if you put a carbon sheet behind the thing that you're typing, in the normal place where a carbon sheet goes, but put it carbon side up instead of carbon side down,
mm-hmm.
then what it does is
it produces a reverse image.
That's right.
I see.
On the back of the sheet.
I see. That's very clever.
Well, I'm glad you think so.
Yeah, it took me a while to get through there.
But let's see now. I was still talking about Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
This trip when I showed appreciation for the sermon was one when it was one of my little tasks at home to look after my grandmother's medicine. And she was using, I suspect it was for rheumatoid arthritis or something of the sort, a preparation that was called antiphlogiston with an ungodly smell. But the doctor required that her temperature be monitored, and that was my job. Of course, in order to have things as sterile as possible, it was necessary to sterilize the thermometer. And to do that, I said, well, obviously, when you want to sterilize something, you heat it. You wash it in hot water. So I washed the thermometer in hot water, and she took her temperature. We looked at the thermometer, and it registered something like 106. So I put in an alarm call to the doctor, and it took a while to straighten things out, but at least I learned that sterilization works for some things, but it's not the best method to kill germs on a glass bulb of something to take your temperature with.
What was the grandmother Ott's first name?
Lydia.
Oh, yes.
Her maiden name was Lydia Rowe, and she was the daughter of the Lydia Augusta Green, whose portrait was in the Springfield, Ohio High School, as I explained earlier. And the next trip to Colorado was the one that I was just discussing. That is when I went the spring following my year of teaching in the country school in Missouri. Let's see.
Now, was that the same time you were wandering around the mining camp and the miners weren't too happy
right.
with you?
I omitted the adventure that I had with my my uncle during that same summer of that same visit to the Southern Colorado. He was trying to make a living by going from one mining camp to another with his sample cases with men's tailoring, as it was called. In other words, ready-made suits which could be altered as if they were custom-made suits. When the agent who went from door to door sent in an order for him with the person's measurements. So I went with him for that on some of his rounds. the first thing that I did for him, which he hardly esteemed as a favor, was to go and to pick up his Model T Ford, with which he intended to drive to the southern part of the state, and as a matter of fact, to drive into the panhandle of Texas, in order to try to do some selling to the oil workers there. The oil fields were just opening up. And so it was my job to take the bus, or I forget just how I did it, to the whatever town it was where he had left his car, and drive it to Alamo, which I did. But about 10 miles from Alamo, I had a flat, didn't know what was I was supposed to do, so I drove on the rim all the way back to Alamo and wrecked his wheel, which, as I said, as you might expect, rubbed him somewhat the wrong way.
I would imagine.
Well, having got the car, he loaded up, and I went along. We drove down to Trinidad, Colorado, crossed over into New Mexico, stopping at a few places to try to make some sales and not having any luck. Got to the Texas Panhandle, the town of Panhandle, and I think we ended up in a little town called Borger, which, as I recall, was an oil town, as that is actually the oil boom was responsible for it.
About what year would this have been?
That would have been the spring of, or summer, I should say, of 1926. So we were in Borger, the weather blisteringly hot, nowhere to get a cool drink of water. Occasionally we stopped and were able to find a tap that had been put to a hose laid on the surface of the ground, but the water that one got from that sort of arrangement was itself practically boiling. But both of us were irritable. I remember that we were down to my last 10 cents, which we spent on a loaf of bread, shared it between us. And shortly after, just he was driving, I guess, I don't know where he planned to end up for the night. But I wanted a drink, and I stopped and went and got a drink. I wasn't quick enough in coming back to the car, which annoyed him. So he started off and simply headed off without me. And here I was stuck. I was left there with no money at all, and needing to, I had no place to sleep, no way to get any food, and I had no money left. I may have had 3 pennies left, which I squandered on at some point during the next 3 days on 3 sticks of chewing gum, which had a little help to allay the hunger a little bit.
So you were there for 3 days?
I was there for 3 days with no food and no shelter. The first night I found a spot close to some billboards which were somewhat out of the wind, and I remember finding somebody's discarded smelly pair of pants that I was able to slip on and keep myself reasonably warm. The next night I sneaked into a lumber yard and slipped between piles of lumber and kept out of the wind in that way. And you can believe me that although this was Texas and one thinks of Texas as a southern state, that plains part of Texas is hot as it may be in the daytime, is uncomfortably cold at night. Meanwhile, I was, as I say, without food, except that I spent a good bit of time at the railroad station. I don't remember why, but in any case, alongside the railroad tracks, where the freight cars were parked, including cars that contained with a cargo of wheat, I was able to glean some grains of wheat from the ground, which appeased my hunger somewhat. And there was some kid my age or a little older who made overtures toward me. I don't mean obscene in any sense of that sort, but was friendly, and was trying to invent some confidence scheme that I might go in with him so as to get some money for the two of us. But something was simply unthinkable to me. Meanwhile, I was still trying to figure out some way of getting word to home, to Versailles, since I had a little money in the bank account there, and I wanted my father to go to the bank and withdraw some of it and send it to me by telegraph. So I, how am I going to get any money to send a telegram? I can send a collect telegram, but I have to make a deposit if I'm going to do that. So I finally swallowed my pride, and I went into a sheet metal shop run by a man by the name of Monday, and if any of his descendants or affines happen to be listening to this tape, I want to express my gratitude for this gentleman here and now, which I haven't had the opportunity to do before. I've never heard from him since. But I asked if I could borrow X amount of money. It might have been a dollar, I don't know, just not very much. And I offered him my hat as security. Well, after hesitating, he lent me the money, and I went to the telegraph station and sent a telegram to addressed to my dad. And then began, that was the third day, began the process of waiting for an answer.
You remember how you worded the
telegram? Oh, yes. I asked for some money. I don't remember whether I said, please take it from my account or what. If I said it that, put it that way, I would have expected him to realize that I did have the money to my credit. But what I got back instead was a telegram from my stepmother, acknowledging the telegram but not sending anything. And that then meant, let's see, what did I do? Oh, I think I asked the telegraph operator if the telegram were from my father, and he was willing to tell me that much. He wouldn't give me the message because since I hadn't paid for it. I should say that the telegram that was sent to me was also a collect telegram. So I couldn't find out what was in it, and the operator was at least willing to tell me who it was from. It was not from my dad, so I thought, well, maybe there's still a chance. He will send me the money, and I stuck around, and a few hours later the money did come through.
Mm. How old were you when all this happened?
Well, if it was 1926, I would have been 19. So with that, a little money in my jeans, I remember I went to the restaurant and ordered something, I don't know what. And I, with all the visions of food that I'd had in the past 3 days, I expected to be able to eat a gargantuan meal. But I didn't realize something that everybody who has gone on a fast knows, that if you do without food for a certain length of time, your innards shrink to the point where they are satisfied with considerably less food. So I didn't eat very much, but I had enough to buy a ticket back to Alamo. And I remember the rather boisterous row that ensued afterwards when my uncle came back home, found me there, and my aunt lit into him for having driven off and left me behind without any way of getting in touch with him. And his excuse was he had tried to find me but hadn't been able to.
He must not have made much of an effort.
About that. So that was part of that visit when I was staying with my aunt and uncle.
Now the place where you had been left by him was the town.
That was in the town of Borger, Texas. Yes.
And how was the name family name Monday spelled?
Just like the M-O-N-D-A-Y.
All right. If I'm ever in Borger, Texas, I'll look up the Monday family
and convey
your appreciation.
Do that. there's nothing else that I can remember worth reporting from that summer. Oh, yes, there was a spring. We had to have a water supply. A spring that was right on the edge of the Arroyo Seco, that is this dry riverbed, which people who have lived in that part of the world will associate with seasonal flooding, but I won't go into that at this point. There was a spring, as I said, on the verge of this stream where we went to get some of our drinking water. We were probably poisoning ourselves because the stuff stank of hydrogen, was it hydrogen chloride, the rotten
sulfide.
Egg stuff, hydrogen sulfide, I mean. The rotten egg stuff. But I remember once when my cousins and I went down to the spring to fetch some water, and on starting back we saw that we were being pursued by a rattlesnake. Rattlesnakes are supposed to be timid, but this son of a gun pursued us almost all the way back to our camp. Let's see, what else? My grandmother came and stayed with with them for a few days that same summer. And I think it was, yes, it must have been right at that time, but I don't know, it couldn't have been. I had already been in Springfield, of course. Yes, it was at that time that it was settled that I would be going to Washburn College, and I think she was able to give me a little money to help things out, to pay my tuition or something.
Your grandmother?
At Washburn, yes.
Now this was your...
My maternal grandmother.
Okay.
When you realize that the tuition at Washburn at that time was only $50 or $75 a semester, you understand how far a small amount of, apparently small amount of money would go.
Mm-hmm. But for purposes of comparison, what would be, say, the price of a loaf of bread?
Price of a loaf of bread would have been a nickel.
A nickel, as opposed to how much now? A dollar or something?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You don't find much bread nowadays under 60 or 70 cents a loaf. Well, let's see. That was that visit to Colorado. Then came the one right after college in 1930, which was when I built my little shack. One thing that I neglected to point out was my way of dealing with the ant problem. Naturally, since there was no any source of food would attract ants from far and wide, I had to have some. I discovered that I had to have some way of protecting my small food supply, which would have included bread and cookies and I suppose one or two other little things. Tried to figure out a way to keep them out, and finally settled on scrounging a fistful of wire, since this was a coal mining camp and the miners used electrical discharge, it would be dynamite, which was discharged by electricity, blast the seams of coal. The arroyo had, among its other debris, a good quantity of copper wire, more or less insulated. So I got a supply of that, took one plank board, and suspended it from the roof of my little cabin so that the ant would have to walk down the wire in order to get onto the board and attack my food supply. But then the question was how to keep the ants from doing just that. So I thought, well, maybe I can use a local product which looks to be pretty plentiful, which was the resin from the pinyon trees.
Hmm.
So I got a couple of wads of that, spread it on the wires from which I had stripped the insulation, and I had no more trouble with ants after that.
Uh-huh.
My double boiler, which I've described, was I was able to use because I could round up a supply of dead pinyon wood build a substantial fire before going to sleep at night. I just then set the stuff on the blaze and let it die, let the fire burn itself out and die away. But my breakfast said it would be ready the next morning.
Well, just what you do these days when you start... When we had a gas stove, you'd put the cereal over the
pilot light.
Yes.
Uh-huh, yes, that's the same idea.
Mm-hmm.
During that... carefree summer, I did a great deal of hiking. I walked from Alamo to La Vita and back. It must have been about 16 miles round trip a couple of times. And I can remember the delight of seeing in the distance a row of cottonwood trees when I was beginning to get very thirsty. And recognizing them as a sign of water not being too far off, and going in their direction and finding a rancher's windmill busily pumping away water and emptying it into a trough which the cattle were able to come and drink from, but which I was where I could stick my face into the gushing, cool, clear water, which was so refreshing on a hot day. I also remember in one of the times that I walked to Levita, being accosted on the street by someone near a church, I believe, I guess it was, who approached me and said, "Have you been saved?" That was, I don't recall what I said, but it's the only time I've had that put quite so bluntly.
Now, was that also when you had the invitation from the lonely household?
No, well, yes, I guess it was. I had was walking near, I think it was a cabin belonging to one of the miners who had decided to have his little place to live away from Alamo rather than in the camp itself. And a woman inside asking me if I would like to come in and rest a while, and having declined the invitation. But did I miss an opportunity? It's always seemed to me since then it might have been interesting to explore that possibility, but, which I passed up. Well, that must just about cover that Colorado visit. I should say that in my construction work, the only thing I spent any money on was a roll of tar paper to keep the rain from drenching me, and also to cover the sides of the little shack so that I could have a dry spot on foggy days, which came occasionally and were very damp and unpleasant. My return to Alamo from Texas was by train, and which meant that I got there considerably before my uncle did. So he had the unpleasant surprise of discovering the person who had presumably decamped waiting for him when he got back, and I guess that added to his displeasure. But I mustn't leave the impression that he and I were at loggerheads in all the years since then. We were on very affectionate terms, and given the conditions of poverty that they were living in at the time, almost anything would be understandable. I went back to Alamo one more time after that, just as a sort of lark. This was after I was married, and stayed a week or so in one of the cabins of the mining camp, which by then had been abandoned as an active mine. The little brick houses were still there. Later on, they were torn down, and I suppose the stuff used as building material elsewhere. But at that time, it was simply a little ghost mining town, you could say. The next Colorado visit was the one that came after my years at USC. And I think that probably should be gone into later. But again, it was an escape from something. It was an escape from Los Angeles, which we had begun to find intolerable, and an escape from my feeling of depression at the fact that I had had a stroke, which, as it turned out, was something actually a good deal more trivial than it appeared. But there was no way to know that then. And going to Colorado was a kind of challenge, which my wife realized was the sort of thing that I needed, even though she must have felt in her heart of hearts that there was some considerable risk. It was one that she was willing to take.
The risk involving leaving USC?
Involving USC, where I had a secure job and was doing well, had just finished work on the Modern Language Association textbook, and all the rest of it that had gone with having done, I think, a fairly creditable job of running a department for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the spread and extent of my Colorado adventures.
Now, you had been at Boulder, I think, hadn't you, a summer before you actually moved out there?
That was the one where the antiphlogiston and the thermometer was at...
what I'm referring to, I think you had a summer teaching job.
Oh, you're right, yes. I did have... this was in the Sputnik period, when the government was subsidizing institutes for language teaching and mathematics teaching and science teaching all over the country. And one of the first institutes was at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and I was part of that as linguist, and was teaching applied linguistics in language teaching.
Mm-hmm. Now, what year would that have been?
That would have been the summer before we moved there, so it would have been the summer of 1959.
Yes. Okay, so on to Washburn? Would that be the next step?
On to Washburn from the summer in my aunt's place in La Vita and Alamo. After that I began my college mm-hmm. career, if you call it that. We're testing with and without the external mic to see what the effect is. Want me to hold it? We're testing with and without the external mic to see what the effect is.
No, it still continues to turn. Pour it on. There you are, sir.
We left off at the point of my following my earlier decision to go to Washburn College. When I referred to it, I think I made it appear to have been something that was decided almost externally. In fact, I had taken it almost for granted that I was going to go to the same school from which my parents had been graduated, and where, as a matter of fact, they had come to know each other. The first question was what my living quarters were to be like. I don't recall having made any extensive search, but the way things ended up was that I got a room in the house of some old friends of my grandparents. This may have been through the instrumentality of my grandmother, who was still living at the time, that is, my maternal grandmother. It was at the house of a couple, elderly couple, named Buehrer, C.E. Buehrer, in Topeka, on the outskirts. I think the address was 2733 California Avenue or street or something of the sort, extreme east edge of the city.
Was this where we last year we went out a considerable distance on some street to looking for the address?
Yes, you and I searched for it, but we weren't able to find it, and I simply had to assume that the place had been torn down
mm-hmm.
and replaced it with something else. At that time, the house that they had, it was the one that Mr. Buehrer himself had built, I think, with the assistance of his son Cletus. But still, having done all or most of the major construction themselves, he was a jeweler or a watch repairman. I'm not sure just how his status would be represented, but a little room in the house, which was his workshop, was animated by the constant ticking of watches and clocks. I remember that much. I recall doing a good part of my studying in the living room of that house, especially during the winter when my own room, which was in the attic, was extremely cold. I was able to bundle up and do some of my work there, but it was more comfortable to sit in the living room with the radio headset over my ears, listening to music while I worked out my my mathematics or my foreign language verbs or whatever it was I was working on. I was with them for my living in their house for the first 2 years, my freshman and sophomore years.
You used the streetcar, did you, to get to school?
It was a streetcar to begin with for at least the first year. And that was a rather pleasant aspect of staying there, because when my day was done and I had finished the work that I was having to do in order to earn part of my keep, I was able to hop the old streetcar, which took the better part of half an hour to travel from Kansas Avenue, which is where I caught it, to California Street, which is where I was living. I can remember some cold December and January nights standing on the corner waiting for that car to take me home. I kept occasionally dropping in at the, was it Liberty Life Building? I think that's what it was. The Topeka's only skyscraper, 10 stories tall, at the corner of 10th Street and Kansas Avenue.
This is the one you pointed out to me near the Southern Pacific headquarters, I think, wasn't it, in downtown Topeka?
No, Southern Pacific. I don't know just what you have in mind there. The Santa Fe Railroad offices were perhaps two blocks from that location.
This was where you got into the conversation with the black man who
Yes,
was operating the elevator?
Yes, exactly. I was just coming to that. There was a black gentleman who was the elevator operator in that building with whom I struck up a conversation whenever I went into the warm lobby of the building to wait for my car. And I remember one evening coming into the building whistling what was that, the piece now? It was, the name of the piece was Badinage, and it's by a French female composer. Her name, of course, slips my mind now. When he heard me whistling it, the elevator operator identified it and said, "I see you like so-and-so." And I was quite surprised. I never expected him to be able to had that sort of musical knowledge. But it turns out that he had trained as a concert pianist. And I think without my elaborating further, one sees again the tragedy of black prospects in those days, in 1926. In any case, my job, I referred it to as a way of earning my keep, was a continuation of what I had tried to do, and perhaps I could say learned to do, although there was not much learning attached to it, with my Uncle John, that previous summer when I went with him on his rounds when he was trying to sell clothing to the Mexican and black and other workers in the Colorado mines and the oil field around the Borger in Panhandle, Texas. I had my sample case and I went from door to door trying to find customers for Nogar, as it was called, N-O-G-A-R, fabric, trousers and suits with my tape measure, making an occasional sale of a pair of pants, which would be enough to keep me in food for the day, or once in a while making a managing to sell a whole suit of clothes, for which my commission might be $3 or $4.
Was the sale of the clothes your essentially your primary source of income during that period?
Perhaps it was, because it was continuous, and the only other income I had was the little that my grandmother gave me, which I think mostly went toward paying the college tuition. I don't remember what arrangement I had with my landlady. It may be that my grandmother was paying that too, $10 a month or something of that sort. Hardly likely to have been more than that. My choice of customers for my clothing, I've mentioned blacks and Mexican, was partly the result of that of the Mexican clientele that my uncle had of that previous summer. And it was simply of the fact that Southern Colorado was and I suppose still is, largely populated by Hispanics. And the fact that I was working among Mexicans was probably the determining factor in my having picked teaching Spanish as a career.
You had really been more interested initially, at least, in music, hadn't you?
If I'd had the means for it, I would have majored in music, yes.
But there were additional fees, were there, involved?
Yeah, yes. Music was beyond my means.
Okay.
I remember now, the name of my composer was Cecile Chaminade.
Mm-hmm.
You asked whether this was my main source of income. It was my main source of being able to eat, aside from the meals that I had at the Bureau House, because when I went out on my rounds, my evening meal would be whatever I was able to pick up at the mom-and-pop grocery store in the neighborhood where I was working. And I can remember quite often making a meal from out of 10 cents worth of sardines and cantaloupe, 5 cents each. My luncheon, I don't remember just when this started, but there was another mom-and-pop store a block or so from the Washburn campus, which was where I went to have my lunch, which consisted mostly, I suppose more often than anything else, of a bottle of milk and a couple of cinnamon rolls and a Saturday Evening Post, which I paid for, I don't remember whether I bought it or not, from the owners of the little store. After my first 2 years, the bureaus decided that they'd had enough of rumors and boarders, and I had to look for another place, and I found something just 5 or 6 blocks from the Washburn campus, which was unremarkable enough for me to have no memory of it, except for the fact that in the parlor, there, in a special bookshelf, there was a set of the Century Cyclopedia, which has just the presence of that there, my being able to consult it, has made me a fan of the Century ever since. Made me appreciate a little more fully the artistry and effectiveness of that dictionary, which was done under the supervision of William Dwight Whitney at Yale University. Whitney being America's greatest historical linguist of the 19th century. I owned a couple of sets of the Century myself, and I have one still, and enjoy consulting it when I want to find out what the pronunciation of a word was in 1900. If I want to prove that gynecology is gynecology and not gynecology, I can look it up there and point the finger.
I remember you were telling me about a favorite professor of yours. You would visit with him and he would smoke, and I think he was a philosopher or something.
Yes, he was my professor. He was my professor of philosophy. He trained as an educational philosopher. Name was Tran Lamar Collier, an Oklahoman by birth, and someone who I found probably the most inspiring of all my teachers, certainly of those that I had in my 4 years of college. My teachers were. I've always felt a high degree of affection for. He was him especially, but my math professor had been the professor of mathematics when my father and my mother went to Washburn. And although she was never my teacher, Miss Levitt, I forget her first name, had been my father's professor of English, and was still teaching at the time. And the librarian at that time was still the librarian who had been who held the position, or held, at least had held a position at Washburn when my parents were in attendance. My math professor, whose name was Harshbarger, as I said, had been the math professor of my parents, I'm pretty sure, if they took math when they were in college. I'm not quite sure whether they did or not. My yes.
I wanted to regress a little. Wasn't it rather unusual for your mother at that time to have gone to college? What would you account for in that fact?
As a matter of fact, it was. In fact, I can recall not too long since a question coming up at a party, which was at where the partygoers were asked how many of them had had both parents with a college education, how many had had one. I don't believe any. I think that I was the only one, or one of two out of several. Both of whose parents had graduated from college. I think it was principally due simply to the fact that my grandfather, on my mother's side, having trained for the ministry, was more or less expected to go to college. At least it was something that was highly regarded, and he graduated from Wittenberg College in Springfield, Ohio, which again points to the importance of Springfield in my family history.
Mm-hmm. And what about his parents?
Neither of my father's parents had a college education, but both my parents did, and my mother's sister did.
Grace.
My grandmother on my mother's side did not. So the college education started with my maternal grandfather. The other one,
right.
The transition.
You're on the air.
A couple of details regarding the Buhrer household.